This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. We take you now to Washington.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war. Such an attack would naturally bring a counterattack, and hostilities of this kind would naturally mean that the president would ask Congress for a declaration of war. There is no doubt from the temper of Congress that such a declaration would be granted.
Yesterday marked the 73rd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, which brought America into World War II. University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of History and author Robert Ernest Miller and David Consett, Cincinnati Museum Center Curator, History Collections and Fine Art, join us to discuss what life was like in Cincinnati leading up to that day and how Cincinnati's people and businesses quickly shifted to a wartime footing. And Dr. Miller's the author of Cincinnati, the World War II Years, and his recently released World War II Cincinnati, From the Front Lines to the Home Front. Thanks to both of you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. Email your questions to talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And talk about what life was like in Cincinnati prior to the U.S. entering World War II.
A lot of people forget just how divided public opinion was prior to the war. A few short months before the attack, October 1941, at Carthage Fairgrounds, a senator from North Dakota, Gerald P. Nye, was the keynote speaker. Robert Taft's wife, our United States senator, appeared at the same event. This was sponsored by the America First Committee. They were an isolationist group that numbered some 600,000 or so across the country, but they had an active chapter here in Cincinnati, and they were all about expressing a viewpoint that was against any involvement in Europe's war at that point.
David, is it fair to say that a lot of people in Cincinnati felt isolated from what was going on in Europe and what was going on in the Pacific at that time?
I think to a degree. I often wonder how many people even actually knew where Pearl Harbor was. one thing I often think about, too, is that we were not all that. Yeah, we knew war was coming. At least the military was preparing for it. And you saw some of this here in town as well. Some of the education contracts that were going on in the industry that, the government coming to various factories here in town saying, can you make this? You know, military contracts, things like this.
If we could go back to the day itself, the events of Pearl Harbor, the Andrews sisters were performing at the Schubert Theater over that weekend from the 5th through the 7th. And it just so happens this year, the calendar lines up, the 73rd anniversary lines up on the calendar day. So the Andrews sisters were apparently setting a record for the Schubert Theater for a weekend performance record. And they showed up on Sunday morning and no one was lined up to buy tickets. No one was in the street. When they walked from the Hotel Gibson to the few blocks to the theater, it was like a ghost town. And they got into the theater and there were a few crew members listening to the radio. And that's when they heard that the attack on Pearl Harbor had occurred. And one of the girls said what probably many, many people said that day, "Where's Pearl Harbor?" Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean to us? You know, so it wasn't just a no-brainer kind of aha moment for people. They had to really figure out what was what in the next 72 hours.
And one of the things, Roger, that I found really interesting from your book were the protests that were taking place in Cincinnati, where you had the people who wanted us to intervene in the war and those who wanted us to stay out. And in fact, there was a pretty remarkable display that the anti-interventionists had that involved caskets.
Yes, absolutely. Again, the America First Committee, I knew about this, and the real treat for doing the research is I discovered the images. And if you can picture Fountain Square as it looked in the 1940s, right next to the Albee Theater, the America First Committee positioned caskets around Fountain Square, and they put signs on them. What they were really protesting at this point in May of 1941 was the convoys that the merchant marines were carrying ships across the Atlantic to protect lend-lease goods for Great Britain. And they were saying basically sarcastic things, like there was a pro-war program called Bundles for Britain that were earlier in the war that initiated packages, care packages for British soldiers. And they put a sign on a coffin that said, Bundles for Britain if, and what they're suggesting is that this policy would lead to American casualties. And America was still neutral in the spring of 1941. So they were obviously against such an act. It stopped people in their tracks.
You know, the image stopped me in my tracks.
Yes,
when I saw that.
The images are riveting in the sense that it's a good reminder that, you know, protest, you know, we think maybe in our minds about certain decades of history where street protests are more prominent than others. But this is in the 1940s when people are going to businesses and shopping and they are just stopping in their tracks, looking at these caskets, and it's doing its job. It's creating a conversational moment about an important national policy.
Did Cincinnati's debate and reaction to the war mirror what was going on in the rest of the country?
Absolutely. David can verify this. Our work with the museum exhibit 23 years ago or whatever it was, every opportunity that I've had to revisit this topic has not really shaken me from, you know, I don't think it's a truism of local history to say that every time you delve into local history that it reflects or parallels national currents. But in this case, it does. In this case, Cincinnati's experience during the defense buildup and certainly during the war years very much emulate and parallel things that are happening in Chicago or New York or San Francisco, places where there's, you know, a accentuated kind of military buildup. That story is unfolding here.
So. I think it's something that whether it's the Japanese government or, you know, the Nazis in Germany really didn't understand about this country. They often looked upon us as a mongrel nation and how we would just collapse. We were not united, and we certainly were.
Well, when the U.S. decided to enter the war after the attack on Pearl Harbor, how did attitudes change toward the war at that point?
I think you saw everybody, a groundswell of support for the war, getting involved, especially after you saw things not only Pearl Harbor, but what was going on in the Pacific, the Philippines, Corregidor, the Bataan Death March, things like this.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Roger, what were some of the things the city did to gear up for the war effort?
Well, the war effort was an opportunity for what makes World War II different from war today is that it presented opportunities for everybody. It didn't matter how old you were. It didn't matter how rich you were. It didn't matter what neighborhood you lived in. There were opportunities, whether it was via the military. That's an obvious, by the end of the war, some 15 million men and women end up in, you know, some capacity, the armed forces. Others lend their services to the industrial workforce. And then, of course, others on the home front engage in a whole variety of activities. Many are volunteer-based, and some are required of the population. You know, there's rationing programs where people will have to learn how to cook without sugar or drive slower speeds because gas is being rationed. One of my favorite examples is the salvage effort. Harold Nichols was a local president of a paper company, I believe, and he stepped up to become the Hamilton County's salvage coordinator. And there were salvage drives virtually in every neighborhood. This meant that, you know, kids could go door to door to collect scrap metal. The movie theaters on Saturday afternoons would have scrap drive matinees. If you brought in like a certain amount of metal or something, you could get into the movie for free. Nichols actually was engineering or intuitive enough to tap into the kind of existing rivalry between Xavier and Cincinnati. And he had a friendly little rivalry between the student population. It's in effect a crosstown shootout of a scrap drive. And Xavier ends up winning by a couple thousand pounds because they dedicated entire football field for Evanston and surrounding neighborhoods to just keep, you know, dumping golf clubs and appliances and whatnot. So
isn't that part of the exhibit, the things that people were donating in these scrap drives, David?
Rationing and scrap drives. And as Bob was saying, this was across the country. Every city, every little village was doing this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the Boy Scouts were involved in all of this, collecting scrap, rubber, metal, everything.
And you have examples of all these different things in the
yeah.
exhibit.
Now, at the time, I often wonder, did they really use all this stuff, or was it more, you know, for the—
Or was it a morale type of thing?
I think it was both. I really think it was both, yeah.
Bob, early on, did people want to attack the Japanese first? Was there a debate about going after the Japanese first versus throwing everything at Germany?
I think that's one of the big puzzles in terms of trying to understand how the war unfolds, because long before the attack on Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt had entered into, in effect, a secret obligation with Winston Churchill. It's really called the Europe First Strategy. And whether or not Pearl Harbor happened, if we were going to become a belligerent nation, an active partner in the process of the war, we had already wedded ourselves to that. I mean, Adolf Hitler does us the supreme favor 3 days after Franklin Roosevelt's call for war and declares war on us. So that just makes it easier from a PR standpoint to say, now we can, you know, first take on, you know, Europe and Hitler's war machine. But it was pretty much in the cards that's a hard sell for some people when "Remember Pearl Harbor" becomes the kind of iconic phrase. You know, the kind of knee-jerk reaction is like, well, let's give it to, you know, the Japs, as they were called at the time. But that had to wait. I mean, there's very few examples in the Pacific War where we could really go on the counteroffensive in a meaningful and sustainable way until Hitler was defeated.
And especially at that time with Churchill was very frightened because of the U-boat warfare at that time in the North Atlantic, that Britain was not going to be able to last much longer with a lot of supplies coming in to the right. to the British Isles.
How did Cincinnati's German heritage play into all this?
That is a very often asked question, and I think, you know, we need to explore that, and we learned a lot of lessons from World War I. World War I was the time frame in which there was men behaving badly, mass hysteria. That's when we changed street names in over the Rhine. German composers couldn't be played during the short duration of World War I. German language newspapers were closed. German language schools were closed. So there was a real clampdown on German culture in World War I, and you don't see that as much. There is an active kind of resurgent German community prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, and the FBI, frankly, is keeping tabs on who the groups are that are all about German culture and the ones that are, you know, more supportive and politically motivated and friendly towards the likes of Hitler. That kind of becomes less of a factor after Pearl Harbor. German Americans are seen as by and large, loyal Americans and supportive of the war.
Because I think if you restricted the German Americans, you'd eliminate a lot of your military.
That too.
Yeah, that too. So Cincinnati had a good industrial base going at the time. And how did local businesses shift gears, David, to deal with this war effort?
Well, one thing, and I don't think a lot of people are aware of this, is in 1940, Roosevelt, you know, they knew war was coming. They were looking at this, or at least they had to be prepared for it. And Roosevelt actually went to General Motors, the president of General Motors, who's Bill Anderson, Big Bill Anderson. He was Danish. And Roosevelt actually made him, I believe it was a major general. It's the only time people had done that. They took the civilian and made him a major general in the army. And they put Anderson in charge of the War Production Board. And they had to triple everything as far as industrial capacity, what they were manufacturing. And as I recall, the first place that Anderson came was Cincinnati Milling Machine Company. He talked to F.V. Geyer, and he said, we need to triple the amount of machine tools that we're making. You know, machine tools were what was going to win the war. The machine tools made the trucks, the tanks, the weapons, and all of this. And initially, Geyer thought, you're crazy. But he said, yeah, we'll do this. And that was the thing, as you know, especially the Japanese and the Germans, you don't pick on the greatest industrial power in the world in a modern war. And they were going to find out why.
Was Cincinnati considered an important strategic site during World War II?
It actually was. And that's another thing that's really hard for people to kind of get their heads around. But the fact that we were an important Midwestern industrial center, people at that time were getting their sense of awareness of the war through newsreels and all the devastation that was wrought in Europe. People were starting to imagine that it might be possible for it one day to cross the Atlantic and be rained down on American cities. So Cincinnati early in the war was considered one of the top 33 strategic cities in the country. And as a result, it got a little bit of federal aid. Usually what we consider civilian defense is falls within the purview of the state and local authorities. But the federal government was able to offer some firefighting supplies. Victory sirens is what they were called, the sirens that you hear go off every first Wednesday of the month for, you know, natural disaster kinds of awareness were put in place in the 1940s as a way to prepare the city's population of an eventual attack. They practiced blackout air raid drills and very extensively for the first couple of years of the war.
Civil defense, air raid wardens, things like this.
Wow. Bob, one of the amazing stories from your book was about the Cincinnati Zoo. They had a rather unusual emergency plan in place, didn't they?
And it should be a comfort to everyone living in that area that in the event that the city was attacked and the zoo was compromised and security for the animals, that they had a system where animals would have to be put down, essentially, so that they couldn't be wandering, you know, wildly throughout the neighborhoods of Greater Cincinnati.
Those are the ones that were considered dangerous. Yes. The lions, tigers, the bears.
Oh, my.
David, talk some about the exhibit that's at the Cincinnati Museum Center. How long is that going on? What kinds of things can people see at that?
Well, that's been up now for, as Bob was saying, 23 years, I guess, now.
What we thought would be a five-year exhibit.
Has turned into a long-term exhibit.
Well, and we have thought, yeah, every once in a while it came up not too long ago, you know, let's take it down and do something else. And I don't think we really can. It's still probably the most popular exhibit that we have in the museum center is the World War II exhibit. And for me, it's war, but it was a real labor of love to go out and interview veterans, interview, you know, the workers that were here in the city. And that's what it's about. It's Cincinnati on the home front. Cincinnati goes to war. And we did, you know, at the end, we did interview some veterans. I'm sure I know Bob did to get that perspective. And I think the interesting part for those guys was, they found out what was going on at home because they were overseas.
Yeah.
You know, it was important to them. But for me, I think the interesting part for me was doing the research on the home front, especially the manufacturing, what was being manufactured here in Cincinnati. And I think many people aren't aware just some of the top secret projects that were going on here. Of course, the machine tool industry, that was probably the greatest help to the war effort was, you know, the machine tool industries, what they were producing for Detroit and all the other large industries. We're still, I mentioned to Bob before the show that I'm still looking for things that I couldn't find 23, 25 years ago for World War II. And they're still coming in. I got one last year. This was a piece that I thought 25 years ago, I thought, where are we going to get this? And it never came in, and it showed up last year. And it was
amazing.
Army field radio that Crosley Electronics made.
Yeah.
And they made, during the war, they made 150,000 of these things. And we finally got one in.
Bob, we've got about 45 seconds left in the interview. Can you kind of sum up for us, how important is it for kids to learn this history, this kind of history nowadays?
Very important. This sounds like it is maybe in the minds of an 18 or 19-year-old about as relevant as the Punic Wars or something like that. But I grew up in a time frame as a sort of late baby boomer where I can look at the events of 1941 and see that it has created our world and continues to shape our world, and it resonates well into the 21st century and will continue to do so, whether we like it or not.
Well, David and Robert, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of History and author Robert Ernst Miller and David Konzett, Cincinnati Museum Center Curator, History Collections and Fine Art. Dr. Miller is the author of Cincinnati, the World War II Years, and his recently released World War II Cincinnati, From the Front Lines to the Home Front. And for a hands-on look at what life was like during the war, check out the Cincinnati Goes to War exhibit at the Cincinnati Museum Center.